This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. My guest this week is the folk singer and activist, the one and only Holly Neer, who I've never met before, but whose music I've been listening to for, well, since I was in college many years ago. She's been at it now for more than four decades. She's received numerous awards, including from the ACLU, the National Lawyers Guild, the National Organization for Women, and she's won the Legends of Women's Music Award, and hell, she's practically founded women's music. Holly Neer, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you. What a lovely introduction.
Well, you've got a new album out called Peace Becomes You. Do you want to talk about that?
I took a two-year break. I was just worn out. And when I got back, I had refueled, and I sat down and wrote a lot of material and went into the studio. And I wanted to also sing other people's material. I like to do covers, as they call them. And by the time we were done, we had enough songs for two CDs. So I was going to release one year and another the next year. And the songs didn't want to be separated from each other. It was really interesting. They were of a piece. And so it's a two CD collection of music. And while I was doing it, I felt like this might be the last recording I do,
really?
At least as a soloist, because there is a point, I'm 63 years old, and there is a point where not everybody, but most people's voices start to not function as well.
And, are you feeling that?
No, not yet, but that day will come, and my voice is stronger probably than it's ever been. That moment when you can drive a truck through my vibrato, I think I will sort of try to fade into the distance somewhere.
Well, you're lucky to still have your voice. I was listening to the last album that Johnny Cash did of the old classics, and it's a very moving album, but his voice is gone.
Well, I think that there are some people who should record, regardless of what their voice sounds like. And maybe their voice wasn't all that good when they were 16, but they have a story to tell, and that there's something inherently emotional about their work. So I'm not saying that older people shouldn't record. I just think because I'm a singer, that my day of appreciating my own self as a singer will come to an end. And I don't... I want to respect that, I think. So we'll see. I could completely change my plans next year, but right now I'm very happy with the way my voice is. It has a kind of witty maturity to it now that I'm enjoying so much. And I watched it happen to Ronnie Gilbert when I was singing with her. She was the female voice in the Weavers. And we toured together quite a bit in 1984, 85. And her voice had taken on that wonderful weight, woody feeling of age and maturity, and I looked at it with great envy, and now I get to have it. So
well, I hope your voice stays forever. So
thank you,
Ronnie Gilbert. Tell me about her.
She's living out in Northern California. She's doing very well. I see her. She seems happy and content and enjoying her elder years. She doesn't perform anymore, although she'll show up and do a talk here or there. And she's a great spirit.
I loved her in the film Wasn't That a Time, about the Weavers. And I think I saw the two of you perform together, if I'm not mistaken.
It was the first time we had performed together, as far as I can remember. We were sitting in a loft in New York City, and Jim Brown, who made that film, asked Ronnie who she wanted to kind of talk to in this interview. And we did, and I began singing a song I'd written about women in Chile, a song called Hay Una Mujer Desaparecida. And then Ronnie sort of started singing it. And it was the beginning of us being able to imagine working in collaboration. I had dedicated a recording to her, my second album, not even knowing whether she was alive. And her daughter gave her the record. And at first, Ronnie was kind of angry, saying, who is this person dedicating a record to me? Doesn't even know me. But she came over to visit, and she listened to the recording, and she liked it a lot, and we became fast friends.
Oh, that must have been fun when she came over for you.
Oh, terrific. She came to my parents' house, and of course, they were thrilled because they had taken us to hear the Weavers when we were very little. And we created an interesting collaboration that was... For folk music, you know, the language really fails us when we talk about music. I don't know what to call the music that I do. And really, Ronnie didn't either, because it comes out of a folk tradition, because we're telling stories about real people's lives, and it's political, it's articulate. And yet, for someone like Ronnie and myself, we're very theatrical people. and neither of us play guitars. So it pushes us more into a cabaret environment, almost maybe a Bertolt Brecht kind of environment. And mixing that theater with the political lyric and with the folk tradition, I hadn't found anybody to work with until Ronnie that had that similar balance of styles. And I find I'm a little out of water if I go to a folk festival, but I'm not exactly in the cabaret world either because I don't wear sequins and sing all love songs. So I had to make up my own category as I went along.
That song you mentioned that you sang together was about the coup in Chile.
Right.
And Pinochet. And you've been down to Chile several times after he finally got removed from power.
He did. In fact, the lawyer, one of the lawyers who was working to try to get him in jail used to say, long live Pinochet, long enough for me to put him in prison. Mm. But that didn't happen. He did die before. It was Letelier's sister who was a lawyer, Letelier who got assassinated in Washington. And she's been putting those thugs in jail ever since. She's in her 80s, 90s. She's still doing it, just still working.
I mean, it is amazing what happened down there. I went to Chile the only time just a couple years ago. Last year, my daughter was on junior year abroad, and we visited the Museum of Memory and Human Rights, which Prime Minister Bachelet or President Bachelet had put together. And it's an amazing, powerful, astonishingly powerful. You go in. Well,
I've
outside
been there.
There
it's
are,
amazing. Yeah. Go ahead, talk about it.
No,
so,
it's just
for your audience.
You walk in, well, first of all, on the outside, there are different quotations from artists and poets and singers about the importance of human rights. And then you go in, and then there's a map of Chile lying on its side horizontally with markings at each little town and city where people were killed, with the number of people killed. And then you go in, this was the really dramatic thing. You go into the main room, and the video of the bombing of the palace is going on. And then you can hear Pinochet and two of the other junta leaders talking that night. In telling people this is for God, country, and whatever the fascists are saying. It's just classic fascist propaganda. Mm. And it was astonishing. And then there are also some more horrific testimonies in there that I could barely sit through.
Very, very difficult to walk through. And there's another thing that goes on that they have in Santiago, which is a park for peace that used to be a horrific prison. Many people died there, were tortured there. It was called Via Grimaldi. And the families of the disappeared, as well as some of the survivors from that prison, reclaimed it and turned it into a park for peace. And they've kept some of the horrific things that took place there. And next to it, they've put art and beauty, which is sort of similar to what you were describing in front of that. If you're going to be able to tolerate the truth, it has to be with an art or an artist standing next to it.
And
it's beautiful.
Have you sung there, Holly Nance?
I did. I was invited by the families of the disappeared to sing there, and went the day before, and there's a large wall of names, not unlike the wall in Washington, D.C. with Vietnam veterans, or Vietnam soldiers who were killed. But so these are people who had disappeared, and we went there, and I was standing looking at it, and there were the names of women that I had called out in the song that I had been singing since the military coup. It's a song I was asked to write by a group of women in San Francisco area who were trying to find women who had disappeared, and they were doing a big fundraiser, and they asked if I would come. And I said, well, this was a long time ago. I said, I don't really know much about it. And they sent me a packet, and I never made it to page 3 because the first 2 pages were the names of people who had disappeared. And the song just started as I called out. It was Michelle Peña Herrera, Nalvia Rosameña Alvarado, Cecilia Castro Salvadores, Ida Meliar Marza, and the list goes on and on and on, singing out these names. And so there we were a few years ago standing in this park. And I looked at the wall, and there were those names that I'd been singing all this time.
It must have been overwhelming.
It's been overwhelming to sing their names every day, but to go there and see the place in which they had been so brutally hurt. And then I was tapped on the shoulder, and I turned around, and there were members of the family. Mm. And some of them would say, would you, tomorrow I know you're going to sing this song at the event, would you add our daughter, would you add our uncle, would you add our grandmother, would you add, and I would just, people were handing me names and handing me names. So the next day when I actually sang it, I said, we are going to, I called out names and I said, there's so many more, and please call out the names of your loved ones. And there was just this silence. And then all of a sudden, a woman stood up and just screamed the name of a loved one. And it was like it opened a floodgate. And then people were just shouting these names. And we just hummed underneath it, and it went on and on. It was quite
extraordinary. Wow,
that
must have been moving.
And then you wonder, how do we as an animal, I mean, here we are an animal. How do we hold the weight of the human experience, which is, we have this spectrum of from spectacular to horrific. And every day, just like our heartbeats and we don't pay any attention to it, every day we're making decisions of where we are on that spectrum.
Also kindness to cruelty.
Yeah, just amazing to look at one's life and say, how did I end up here? No matter, I mean, I could easily have been the fascist.
Right.
And I would have been very good at it.
No, come on.
Well, I do think so. I think the way to try to understand us as an animal is to realize that we actually are capable of either end of that spectrum. Mm. And it's our, it's how we come into the world. It's what kind of upbringing we have. It's whether we're honored as children, whether we got beaten to death or sexually abused. I doubt there's anybody out there that commits horrific crimes that wasn't hurt as a baby. Mm. And I think until we understand that, that it, we won't be able to turn that around.
It is. That is a huge issue. You know, how do we come to grips with what happened in Chile, what happened in Nazi Germany, what happened...
What's going on in Syria, what's going on, you know.
And to realize that there's got to be an element, if not in all of us, in a whole mess of us that can turn into that fascist who turns in his neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And tortures people. I mean, that that's the horror of the 20th century, and of course of all of human history, really. But but it's balanced out by the people who are doing all the good too.
And if we always think of it as political, which I grew up thinking, I came from a leftist family, I think we miss opportunities to understand the problem, which I do believe we have to look at mental illness and addiction and abuse, and these things that in some strange way, when I look back and I remember being a part of the early women's movement, this phase of it, and of feminism, and people came up with this phrase that the personal is political is personal, that I continue to understand that again and again and again, the older and wiser I get, that comprehending that phrase, and I know someone said it, and I'm not remembering who, whether Robin Morgan or somebody put that phrase together, but it's not something one learns just in a moment. I keep revisiting it and trying to sink into my own self. And right now, the one that's just busting me is this climate crisis.
Mm-hmm. And you sing about that in this new album, too.
I do, and yet I'm not singing about it deep enough. I'm having a hard time grasping how to personalize it, this political issue, how to make... I saw a T-shirt at a festival I was at the last summer, and it was a big, burly guy who was working the stage crew, and his T-shirt said, "No planet, no party." Yeah. I went, there you go. Oh, that's it.
That's a seller, I think.
No matter whether you're working in childcare or food or anti-war or whatever it is, if this climate crisis issue is not a part of our organization, then what's the point of doing all this work? And you read statistics like 90% of the deep water fish in the world are gone. And I read that and I go, I don't know where to put that inside my body. I don't.
It isn't amazing.
I don't know what to do.
It's an amazing
threat. I'm working on it.
You know, you mentioned the T-shirt. I saw a bumper sticker that stuck in my mind that isn't really related directly to global warming, but I thought it was a classic, and that was, use just a little more kindness than is necessary. And I just thought it was perfect. You know? Instead of just, you know, random acts of kindness, here's random acts, a little more kindness. And I thought that was sweet. But on this album, Peace Becomes You, Holly Near, you have this song, well, one line, you talk about loving the planet, it's right there, but I like the Seemed Like a Good Idea at the Time song, which is about the automobile.
The development of the car. Oops. Oops, sorry, we went in that direction. I mean, I lived in Los Angeles quite a bit, and there was no great public transportation there because all the auto industry and the tire industry came in and said, we're going to make this a car town. And I was very sad when we were bailing out automobiles because I felt like we should take all of those workers and train them to do something else and come up. It's not as if you can make the cars better. We have to learn to live without them. And it's like climate. We're not there yet. We're just, the population is not ready to give up our comforts and our transportation.
I mean, though you can make the cars a lot better in that, you know, mm-hmm. the average car, what, gets 22 miles to the gallon, and you could get a car that goes 100 miles to the gallon.
You could, but you still got to build the highways.
Right.
And,
well, that's true. There are these cities in Europe, I guess, that are essentially car-free, which is interesting.
See, I love that idea. I had an uncle who was a city planner of Philadelphia, and he went to Beijing a long time ago and said, you are so far ahead of the game here because of bicycles. But they didn't listen to him. They right. now have cars and pollution just like everybody else.
Yeah, and but if everyone in China wants the things that we've got, the planet's not going to survive.
Oh, just amazing, isn't it? And then if you think of everybody who's on the planet and each one of us decide to have a baby, I mean, it's just the night. I'm completely overwhelmed by the question. One of the songs that I really love on the new CD is the title cut, Peace Becomes You. And I had a poem, a lyric, and I gave it to John Fromer. Do you know John Fromer? Mm-hmm. John Fromer was a wonderful singer-songwriter out in California, and I say was because he recently died of cancer mm-hmm. way too soon. He was a labor organizer. Went to SOA, the School of America Watch, at Fort Benning every November, and I just adored him. Anyway, he was in the process of leaving the planet, and I called him, and I said, do you want to write music to this song? If you don't, I totally understand. He said, no, I do. And he wrote music right up through hospice. Mm. He had his nephew in there taking down the songs he was writing. He just stayed in the music right to the last moment. And so he wrote the music to Peace Becomes You, the title
And the
song.
Lyrics are great, too.
Aren't they? I mean, I'm not blowing my own horn, but I got to say, I love that lyric because it has to do with the ways in which we fall in love with each other. Certainly, we fall in love by looks. See a cute person across the floor, you know, or love their hair or their eyes or their rear end or whatever it is you fall in love with. But our minds, what we think, what we believe in, how we act in the world, I think is a big part of what I fall in love with.
And the one line in there that just sticks in my head is, you know, I love the way you walk the picket line for a living wage or something like that.
Yeah. It's just, or how you grab a thought and put it into practice. These just different ways in which we admire one another. So.
Yeah, minds can be a really kind of fascinating lovable things. Yeah. They also can turn against you, and that's what mental illness is, when your mind becomes your enemy. Such a weird little instrument, isn't it? Strange.
Well, it's amazing it works at all when you look at the way our bodies function. That's just amazing.
Well, and we're bombarded by so many things, too.
Yeah.
You mentioned some of the bad things that can happen to kids, and then we're in this war-making society, and
then the other side of it, these delightful children who are so smart. My nieces and nephews are all smarter than I was at their age. They have learned from us, and the young men in our family they don't even have to use the words. They are inherently feminist men, and it's just beautiful to watch them. And the girls are strong and physical and bright, and they just didn't have the same battles. They've got their own, a whole new set of them, but I love watching young people absorb what went before them and just keep moving on with great energy. It's beautiful.
One of the things, Holly Near, that one line that I saw in the lyrics that I was reading from this new album, Peace Becomes You, is it's you take the teenager's side who's wearing the
headphones
and noting that, you know, maybe the music in those headphones is represents a refuge against a family that may be cruel.
Yeah.
And I hadn't seen it put it that way. I mean, talk to me about music, the role of music. You're not a sentimentalist in that you know that some music can be muzak or can be marching music, war music. On the other hand, you also, in this album, talk about how liberating
how
music
is.
Yeah.
Well, it's one of the most powerful things in the world, and one of the earliest sounds that humanity made was drums and bird call, and we made music from the beginning. It's a way in which we communicate. It's a way we heal and soothe. It's a way we agitate and organize and create revolution. It's entertaining. It's all those things. I don't know anything as powerful as music, and it doesn't necessarily have to have words, but when it does, the writers who take care about what words they're going to use. I know songwriters say, well, you know, it's not exactly what I meant. And I say, well, then why did you say it? You know, it's hurtful. Think about what you're saying. You have power. If you really want to hurt someone, go on. That's what you're doing. But if you don't, be careful. These words are so, and I think it's true with our children. Be careful with what you said. A little more kindness wouldn't hurt. We talk about our children in front of them. You think they're not listening? Of course they're listening. And
Do you take a long time to write your lyrics?
No, I don't. I feel as if they are brewing since birth, and then at some point in time in my life, I open my mouth and they go bleh, and they come out. So I practice a kind of active noticing, I guess is what I would call it.
And so do you keep observing, write notations as you're going along, or talking to a recorder or something?
In a pretty unorganized way, napkins and business cards and things like that. But it's more like when I finally sit down to write it and I get out of my own way. If I try to write the song, it tends to be rhetorical and overstated and boring. And then at some point, I can't quite explain what happens, but I get out of the way. Mm-hmm. And then this inherent knowledge that I have from having paid attention has room to come out. And oftentimes the first bit is a lot of garbage because I'm mentally making it happen as opposed to saying, look, trust, you have been paying attention. Now let what you've learned from that come forward.
And how do you get beyond the perfectionism that, oh, I've got to do something that's just really great? Because I think that can be really paralyzing.
It can be. I think one just has to be willing to be humble. I let the audience also determine a lot about whether a song has worked or not. I love to sing a song in front of an audience right after I've written it as opposed to after I've perfected it. Because the audience really will tell me whether it works or not.
And will you go back and rework it, or will you junk it?
I'll rework it for 40 years.
You know, that's how a comedian works.
Yeah. Just reorganizing it, and people will say, oh, you changed the words because they've been listening to it on the record. And I say, well, I learned something, and I think this is a better way to say it.
I always wondered whether songwriters get tired of singing their old verses, or if there's an old verse that just kind of rings wrong after a while, and they just can't stand to sing it anymore, and they want to sing it better.
Well, those songs hit the shelf in my world, but I don't work in pop, you know, top 40 radio. I suppose if you had a multi-million-dollar hit, you kind of have to sing it. I often wonder with B.B. King how he gets away with singing Thrill Is Gone. He must really think the thrill is gone on that song, you know. But
still gone.
He's still singing it and playing it on the guitar, bless his heart. But I have songs also that I just can't do anymore. One, for example, I wrote in 1970, I want to say 72 or 73, called No More Genocide in My Name. And it was a very powerful and wonderful song in its time, but I just can't sing it anymore.
Why?
I can't, I just don't feel it in the way that I did. And so it's kind of rote. I think I sang it so much. Mm-hmm. And as a performer, I can't find it anymore. Mm-hmm. And so to me, I just write a new song about it. Right. So I'll have other songs that speak about racism or genocide and with a different tone from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. But it could have been me as another song. I sang so much that it's hard for me to just do it genuinely anymore. And I hold them up.
And that was about Kent State, that one, right?
Yeah. I was asked to write that for one of the early memorials. And I actually was failing. I was in the airplane about to land in Ohio, and I still hadn't finished the song. And I just sort of was shaking myself, saying, back to this personal political, I said, you're so rhetorical. What did you really feel about this? And it came into my mind, well, I could have been one of those kids. And then that was the beginning of it. It could have been me.
But still, you do, as you say, sing about maybe not genocide with the same lyrics, but you sing about war on this new album, Peace Becomes You. War is child abuse for which our taxes pay. That's the first line of that song.
I love that song, I must say. There's a wonderful violin solo on that song played by a Palestinian musician out in the Bay Area, George Lamam. And there's a lot of sounds on this recording, intentionally chosen musicians to bring So in that song, it doesn't say anything about the Middle East, but his presence as a violinist on it puts it geographically in a place.
And do you sing about the Middle East much? I remember Ronnie Gilbert talking about how hard it was for her to come around to that.
I have references to Gaza in one song and then having Georges play on this song, War. And I think I move in and out of what goes on in the Middle East, but I haven't written a song per se about it. It's a big subject, first of all, the Middle East. It's kind of a catchphrase for a really big subject. I'm not sure how I would write a song about that. But I try to make sure that there is an awareness that there are Palestinians in the world and that there are Native Americans in the world and that there are children in the world and that there are lesbians in the world. I mean, I try to look at the people who are oftentimes the most discredited and just try to make sure that there's a presence in my work, not necessarily a song about, which puts people kind of ghettoizes that this is that group, because not all Palestinians are the same, but just an awareness that we are people and the earth sharing this planet together, and just try not to leave anybody completely ignored and forgotten. Mm.
We only have about a couple minutes left. I'm speaking with Holly Neer. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive. There's been a lot of progress in this country over the last 45 years since...
I thought you were going to say 400 or 500 years.
You've been at it. No, there's been that too. But I'm thinking of the women's movement. I'm thinking of the great nonviolent revolution that's been the LGBT revolution. Mm-hmm. I mean, look where we are with same-sex marriage coming along. And
The Occupy movement.
You were down at Zuccotti Park. That must have been fun.
It was totally fun. I loved seeing what young people were bringing to the table. I've heard people say, well, yeah, but what did they actually achieve? And I want to say, you're talking about it. Our generation could not get that conversation rolling. And then Occupy came along, and it was in the front page. The 99% was everywhere. I think it was totally successful.
And it got us talking about inequality. We've been talking about inequality in this country.
A long time, yeah.
Such a long time.
It was good. Class, money, jobs. It was and continues to be a very important phase in our development in our country, I think.
I was thinking of a lyric in this new album, Peace Becomes You. It's in the song Here Comes the Hard Part, which talks about the difficulties we've had to overcome. Mm-hmm. But check out these few lines. People do the impossible, and history has shown the impossible becomes the probable. I love that line. Change crashes through the door, and lives are changed forever, forevermore. Mm. That must have been an inspiration that came nicely to you.
Well, that was a hard song to write, but I'm pleased with how it turned out, and I had some wonderful singers working with me on that. But I believe that it is hard. It is hard to try to think through and figure out how to be a meaningful human being on this planet. It's the only planet we know of that has life on it like this, and we get to be here. We're spinning through space at an unimaginable rate of speed. It's just odd when you really think about it. If you wake up every morning, it's odd. But I think a challenge for me is to figure out we don't know how to protest a president we love. And so we're having a very hard time going up against Obama, who we were very happy historically to have become president, and say to him, you just can't support drones.
Right. This is a real problem and a lot of issues with Obama. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I'd love to talk about that for another half hour.
Oh, chapter two. We'll have to talk another time. It's been great being here. Thanks so very much.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Holly Neer, thanks for so much being my guest.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.